an instant friend. And the ironic thing is, during the day, actually it was sometime last night, he mentioned to me that his educational background, which is pretty impressive. He's got his bachelor's from St. John's, and he's got a master's from Penn. And I'm thinking, geez, a master's from an Ivy League school, that's pretty impressive. But Bobby, I guess I don't teach much about civil rights leaders in Ivy League schools, do they? Ladies and gentlemen, Bobby C.
My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. You may think I have some accent. I don't. I'm just coming over a cold that I had for like the last, I don't know, 46 years. I was embarrassed because, I mean, I know where it happened in Memphis. I know the name of the hotel, the Ring Hotel. But I felt stupid. But because it's been a while since I've been to Atlanta. Actually, the last time I was in Atlanta was in 1994. We actually did Equipah. They actually did it downtown at the Marriott on Peachtree Street. I remember that because at the hotel right across the street was the Georgia State Convention of Narcotics Anonymous was going on at the same time. And we were yelling back and forth, read the book, keep it clean, keep it sober. And actually, your chairman, Tom, actually, that's how I met Tom. Tom was involved in that committee, actually joined the advisory council of Equipah, and I've been giving him a hard time ever since. But it's good to be back here. It's always a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I am supposed to tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. It's June 2nd, 1988. My home group is the Underground Group. We meet at the Old Pine Community Center on the corner of 4th and Lombard in South Philadelphia three nights a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 8 o'clock. If you're ever in the neighborhood, please stop by. We'd love to have you. We'll go out for hoagies and cheesesteaks afterwards. I seen a cup. So there's a joint here called Jersey's, Mike's, Subs. Don't go there. We don't call them Subs. They're hoagies. As soon as he said Subs, Mike ain't from Jersey. I don't know where he's from, but he's not from Jersey. I guarantee that. Probably from Savannah. All right. So this is it. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar working neighborhood in Philadelphia. I got seven brothers and sisters. We had no booze at all in my house. My father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. My mother was pregnant for almost 10 years. She was. There are eight of us within a 10-and-a-half-year span. I have a sister who is 11 months older than me, and I am 11 months older than my next sister. Irish octuplets. So she was pregnant all those years, but unfortunately she also suffered from a history of mental illness and abuse prescription medication, and because my dad didn't drink, he was smart enough not to have any booze at all in the house. My grandparents lived around the corner from us, and their basement was finished as a bar, and that's where all the family functions were held, the graduations, the christenings, and things like that. And that's where I had my very first drink. I loved my grandparents. My grandparents were good people. They were immigrants, and so the kids from the neighborhood used to make fun of them because they used to speak kind of funny. But, come to the neighborhood, check it out. But I loved them, and every weekend there was some sort of function. My father was one of 11. My mother was from a much smaller family. She was one of 10. But, and I got tons of cousins, and there was always a party, a graduation, and I just loved the excitement there, And that's where I had my first drink. I was just a kid. I did not get drunk the first time I drank. I remember what it was. It was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father, and Ballantine had their old scoreboard in right center field. And I was running around the basement bar polishing off the half empties or the half fulls. I guess it all depends on your perception. But I was polishing off the half empties, and my uncles were pointing at me. He said, "Look at Bobby." And that's what I always craved. I never felt a part of. And that would be true even to early recovery. And that's pretty tough to do when you got 10 people living in a small 3-bedroom row home. But I never felt a part of, My drinking really kind of took off in high school. Most of the kids in the neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school. But my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. Because they knew, them being first generation here, they're really the only way to make it here is by education, And most of my dad's, four of my dad's brothers went to Annapolis, and so did three of my mom's brothers, free education. But they knew education was the only way to make it here. So, but I felt kind of different when I went to this school, because most of these kids were from very affluent families from the suburbs. And it was just me and a couple other dirtballs from the neighborhood who went to this school. And we had a reputation because the school was in a pretty rough neighborhood, and we used to walk. And it was a lot of these kids, it was their first introduction to the inner city. So as their parents were dropping them off in their luxury automobiles, me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. And I knew that was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me by the nuns as a kid and by my parents. But the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. And one of my nicknames was Crazy Coyle. And I would do things in my gut that I felt uncomfortable doing. But I was your entertainment committee, and I didn't want to disappoint you. And we did all types of things. Like, we sold football pools, and if you hit, we didn't pay off. Well, what were you going to do? You know, you wanted to buy certain substances, we sold you substitutes. Like, what was you going to do? We went through a lot of oregano. But what were you going to do, you know? And I guess we thought we were gangsters, and oh, it was nuts, you know. I remember my freshman year at the prep. It's September, it's football season, there was a away game, there was drinking, there was fighting, there was police activity, really a lot of fun. And I remember we all had to go see the disciplinarian the first day back to school. And he had about 10 of us lined up outside his office, and they were all upperclassmen, except me and another kid from the neighborhood. We're the only two freshmen. And I remember the priest came up to us. He said, what's with you guys? You guys here like 2 weeks, and you're getting this jackpot already. And I just shrugged my shoulders. I said, you know, Father, just one of them things. You know, and what it was, that would be the story of my life. It didn't take me long to size up situations. I didn't play football, so I didn't hang out with those kids. Even though I did somewhat well academically, it wasn't cool, so I didn't hang out with the AP kids. I was there about a week and a half. I found out who the nitwits were, and that's who I hung out with, you know. And that would be the story of my life. New circumstances, who are the nitwits? I'm with you, guys. Here I go. I'm with you. This school's in a pretty rough neighborhood. It sits on the corner of 17th and Girard, and three blocks away is the subway, the Broad Street subway. At the end of the day, these kids from the suburbs would have to take public transportation home. But they were scared to walk to the subway. They would wait on 17th Street for the trolley. They would wait half hour, 45 minutes for the trolley. You could have been walking back and forth like four or five times. Well, two blocks away on the corner of 15th and Girard was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. When I was a junior, I was a regular at the Ebony. Now, I went there for a couple of different reasons. They had cold beer, you know, they had dancers and, you know. But a lot of times I went there was to show off how tough we were to the kids from the suburbs, because they definitely thought we were lunatics. And I can now tell you I'm not a tough guy. I never was. And every time I strolled out that street and I sat in that bar and ordered a drink, I was terrified. But I didn't want anybody else to know, you know, playing the roles, you know. I mean, I'm what? I'm 16. I probably look like I'm 12. I probably dress like I am now, you know, blazer, gray slacks. I mean, I wasn't wearing pink back then. That only comes with a fist step. But, you know, but like a striped tie. I mean, and these, as you can tell by the name of the establishment, they knew that we weren't from the neighborhood. But they figured if we were goofy enough to go in there, they would serve us. And it was just nuts. I remember when it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education. And that kind of ticked my parents off, because they made a great deal of sacrifice to send me and my brothers and sisters to private school. So I know I couldn't stay home because there's hell to be catched, and I don't like catching any hell. So I thought my options were limited. I'm what? I'm 17. I got nowhere to go. You know, no money, no experience. What am I going to do? So the only thing left available to me at that time was to enlist in the service, and that's what I did. Even though I had an opportunity to also go to Annapolis, but I was smart enough to know that I would have got jammed up down there, and that would have been a serious problem. But I enlisted. That really wasn't a bright move. Because back then, nobody else was going. The military wasn't popular. Things going on in the 70s. But I enlisted. And after my training, I wound up getting sent overseas for 13 months. And that's when my drinking really took off. You know, I was there a couple months, and several good friends of mine got killed. And I know how to handle that. Because of my neighbor and my family, we didn't talk about nothing. It's all surface stuff, you know. And once you moved out of the house, whether you went away to school or you got married, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. If you lived in the house, everything stayed inside you. And once you moved out, everything stayed within the walls of the house. And you just said no. And that's not a shot at my folks. I mean, that's just the way it was. And I don't know how to handle this. You know, my friend's getting killed. But, you know, booze numbed the pain, and that's what I did. I drank to numb the pain. I didn't distinguish myself, but I didn't do badly either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. I didn't want any attention. Good attention, bad attention. I didn't want anything. I didn't want you to notice me. I just skated along and did my job. Now, I didn't mess around with other substances because I had a fear. I knew a lot of guys from the neighborhood who had gone over and got whacked on certain things, and I actually had a fear of other substances. But drinking, I had a drinking problem before I went in, and it definitely grew more advanced when I was there. When my tour was up, I came home. I wound up taking a couple civil service exams, and I enrolled in school. And I went to St. Joe's, not St. John's. St. John's is in New York. St. Joe's is a Jesuit school in Philadelphia. I went to St. Joe's. These guys from Boston, I don't know. I asked him what he's doing here. I thought he was like a witness protection program. What are you doing in Georgia? I went to St. Joe's. Back then, it was a small school. It's a small school now, but when I was there, there was no more than 3,000 of us, you know, and through all 4 years, total students, about 3,000. So the classroom's small. There were about 15, 20 of us in the classroom. And the same thing at St. Joe's. I'm not making the dean's list, but I'm not failing out either. Give the bare minimum effort required to get by. One of the guys called me the night before. He said, Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. You want to go to the game? It was one of those businessman specials, like one of those midweek afternoon games. I said, sure, because I'm not setting the classroom on fire. They're not going to miss me, so I don't participate. So it was at the end of the semester, the end of the spring semester. It was May. And so I went to the game. And the Phillies had since moved. They're playing the Vet Stadium in South Philadelphia. And me and the guys from the neighborhood, we're at that top of the 700 level drinking that cheap watered-down beer. And it was an unusually warm day. And the sun's beating down on me. I'm getting trashed. And I told one of the guys I was with, I said, you know what? I'm going to run down in the field and meet one of the players. And they said, okay, Bobby. And they kind of shrugged me off because another nickname I had besides Crazy Coyle was Bullshit Bob. I used to tell people, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I did that. I didn't do nothing. I made stories up. That's all I did. I talked to you. I should have started off Once Upon a Time. I mean, I sat in a bar store. I lied about everything. I didn't do nothing. So, but I had worked my way down. I had jumped over the fence. The San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I went out and I shook his hand. I said, hey, Dave, how you doing? And he looked at me. He said, brother, what are you doing out here? And he's a pretty big dude. And I peeked from behind him. I saw the guards coming. I said, Dave, I got to go now. So I start running towards the infield. I want to slide into second base. And as I don't know why, I just thought that'd be pretty cool to do. So as I was running towards second base, there was more guards coming from the third base side. I know I couldn't do that because if I slid, I'd get caught. So I start walking towards first base. And I'm as close as a guard as probably Cliff and I are right now, right? I'm walking to give myself up. At the last second, I deked the guy and I ran out in the outfield. Now I'm running around like a screwball. It seems like about 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to 2 or 3, right? But the place is going nuts. I mean, I'm in good shape. I'm just out of service. I'm juking and driving. They can't catch me. But you know what? I got nowhere to go. The fence is 12 feet high. I'm drunk. I'm out of breath. I'm about to get sick. Like, what do I do? So I got tired of running around. So I just stayed in center field. I'm waiting for them to catch me. And I had these young, short, fat guys. It was like the Keystone Cops. They were all tripping over each other. I'm telling you, they put Mr. Excitement up on the scoreboard. The place was going nuts. They took me off the field. I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. I swear to God. Yeah. The place is going nuts. They take me up to the right field bullpen, and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen and gave me the thumbs up. Way to go. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from these guards because I made it look so stupid. They could have beat on me all day long. I didn't care because you know why? I could drink for free off this story. I was going to be a legend in the neighborhood. I knew it. I figured by the time I got out of jail, I'd be back in the neighborhood. I'd be like the conquering hero. Now, I knew this would be the type of story that I'd make up, you know, like Bullshit Bob, right? But I had them four other guys from the neighborhood. I knew they had my back. You know, they'd be telling stories I could drink for free. I actually pictured this as I was about to get my beating. Just then, the Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, what's the matter with you? He said, are you drunk? Are you high? I said, no, I'm just happy. I'm just happy to be here. He said, well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium. So he saved me from getting a beating, but more importantly, he saved me from getting arrested, which was kind of important, because about 6 weeks later, I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They was hiring anybody back then. You know? I got hired, you know, I'm not even old enough to drink. The drinking age in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has always been 21. I tell you, it was hard to drink in Pennsylvania. I mean, not that I ever let that bother me, but for instance, to drink, to this day, you got to go to the state store. When I travel and go to places and find that you can buy like beer and wine like in a 7-Eleven, that still throws me for a loop. You got to go to the state store, and the state store is only open at 7 o'clock on Monday, Tuesday, 8 o'clock Wednesday and Thursday, and Friday, Saturday, 9 o'clock. That's it. It's closed on Sundays. And the only way to buy beer, you go to the bar to buy a six-pack, or you go to the beer distributor and buy a case. That's it. There's nothing in between. And So it was hard. So, but I didn't care. So, but Jersey was right across the river. Where I lived in Philly, I could be over in Jersey quicker than other parts of Philadelphia. And that time, the drinking age in Jersey was 18. So we used to go over to Jersey all the time, you know. So, but once I got on the job, I no longer needed to do that. We had a mayor at the time, a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. Frank was a former cop, a police commissioner, and he loved us. And to be honest, we were nothing but a gang with badges. We did whatever the hell we wanted to do. We were 8,300 strong, and it was just nuts. And I was off to the races. I remember when he swore us in. He said, "Fellas, in your hand, you're holding a ticket to the best show in town." And he wasn't lying. You know, it was great. My first 10 years, I spent in North Philadelphia, where I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the tour, I would go out with guys with the squad and drink to numb the pain. I saw things on the job that bothered me, but I couldn't tell my coworkers that because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys. To the point where I engaged in behaviors I knew was wrong, the way I treated and spoke people and did all that other nonsense. But the need for me to be accepted by these guys outweighed anything else. So whatever values were instilled in me by the nuns as a kid and by the Jesuits and by my parents went right out the window. And the handwriting was on the wall. I need to back up for a moment and tell you about that story about running on the field. I tell that story for a couple of different reasons. One, it's a true story. I get them four guys from the neighborhood. They can back me up. They're still alive. Secondly, you know, it's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a lover. I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused every person I came in contact with. Believe me, I was a creep. And thirdly, and more importantly, I was a major blackout drinker. I remember when I eventually got sober, I was in the VA hospital, a doctor came up to me and said, "Listen, do you ever need blackouts?" I said, "No." "I must have answered too quickly for me." He said, "Do you know what they are?" I said, "No." When he told me, I said, "All the time." I thought that's how you knew you had a good load. If you woke up the next day and didn't remember the night before, that was a good load. And I remember I would, at a young age, I'm talking in my late teens, I would, you know, and even in the service, I would be out, you know, with the guys, and I'd wake up the next day, and whether I was in the neighborhood or in the corner or in the service, guys would tell me stories of the stunts that I had pulled the night before, and a few hours later, I would be repeating these stories like I remembered myself, and I had no memory whatsoever, you know. So I'm on the job, and I'm at work one day, and my immediate supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid? You're smart, you're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up. In one ear and out the other." I'm at a family function one time, and my uncle was there. My uncle was a boss in the job, and he had pulled me off to the side. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better take it easy." In one ear and out the other. Several years later, on two separate occasions, I ran into my uncle and that supervisor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that they were trying to 12-step me. And I remember talking to my Uncle Jimmy. I said, "Look, man," I said, "how come you didn't tell me, you know?" And he gave me one of them old-timer smiles. He said, "Bobby, you just weren't ready yet," which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I was 24 years old and shot and killed a 15-year-old kid in the line of work in a terrible situation that couldn't be avoided, you know? They now have a phrase, suicide by police, but 20-some years ago, that wasn't around. And I use it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for my next 3 years. I got sober when I was 27. Drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and one of those nevers was the use of other substances. I wound up getting moved on my job and got transferred, and I was put in a position. I was drinking. My judgment was impaired. And I was put in a position where I thought I needed to do other substances, and that's what I did. I got involved in other substances, one of my nevers. My use of other substances is very short. It lasted 17 months. It caused me and a lot of other people a lot of problems. And out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's why I need to talk about that stuff. It just went with the territory, so you can use your imagination. I'm sitting home from work one day, and I'm reading the Daily News, and there's an article in the paper, and at the end of the article, there's a couple questions, five questions, along with the phone number. It said alcohol problems, drug problems, marital problems, depression, thoughts of suicide. I was 4 out of 5. I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I would have been batting 1,000. You know? And they talk about the moment of clarity. As soon as it came, it quickly left. But I cut that ad out and I stuck it in my wallet and I continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. I'm sitting in the bar. Guys in my squad were in trouble. We were there to get our story straight. I guess we forgot our primary purpose. It turned out to be a drinking party. We got drunk, and one of the guys I worked with, he said he needed to go home for some reason. And I said, I'll give you a ride home, because I did not think that I was drunk as he was. He thought that was a pretty good idea. Now I'm a show-off. I was very aggressive on the job, a lot of press, and in case you happen to miss it, I'd have about 4 or 5 articles in the back of the car. I'd sign and give it to you if you was interested. So I'm going to show off in my driving skills, you know, because I would see things on television or in the movies. I said, I could do that, you know. I couldn't. Now, you know, all that stuff is prearranged, and you stunt guys and all that other stuff. I didn't care because they weren't my cars I was driving. It was the city cars. And, you know, I tore cars up left and right, and they knew. But you never confess. You never. Man, you deny it to the end. And they would tell me, and I should have, again, I should have started like once upon a time. I told these outrageous stories, and they would look at me, you know. So I have this car, and I'm going to show off my driving skill. And again, it's not my car. So I'm driving out the street, and there's a kid riding towards me on a bicycle. It's a narrow one-way street. We got a lot of those in the city. And up on my left-hand side was a big stone wall, about 12 feet high. And for some reason, I thought it'd be funny to run this kid up on the wall and let him grab the wall. I don't know why. I just thought that'd be funny. Now, and unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction I ran this kid over. As he lied, bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car with my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me in the city for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw that off the street like a piece of trash. Drove back to the bar, made some sort of smart-aleck remark, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody helped me because I was such a creep. And believe me, I was a creep. I didn't know what to do. So I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, some other substances, and I checked into a hotel with the intentions to consume all this stuff to build up the courage to end my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the hotel door and to kick me out, you know. It was funny. On my way down, I had like the last 2 months of the Grapevine, March and April's Grapevine, and I'm reading, and there must have been this, I think it was the March article, there must have been about 4 or 5 people who finished their drinking in a hotel room, you know. So they're knocking on the hotel door to kick me out. And at this point, I was suspended from my job. I no longer had access to my weapon, so I couldn't shoot myself. So I walked over to the window, and I was going to jump out the window to end my life, you know. And I opened up the window, and I was on the 5th floor. I remembered I was scared of heights. I made 23 jumps in the service. I never overcame my fear of heights. So I went in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub up with water, and I had a blow dryer, and I was going to pull the blow dryer in the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I'd pull the blow dryer in the tub, it would come unplugged. I was like about 1.5 feet showing on cord, and it's like that scene, I'm in the tub and I'm trying to lean a plug in, you know? And it's like that scene out of Woody Allen movie where he couldn't even kill himself, you know. And that's okay to laugh, but you know, I never want to forget the pain I was in that day. The only other tool that I had left was my car. So I took one last spin through the neighborhood. I started up the Falls Bridge, and I come down the East River Drive to end my life in an automobile accident. And the East River Drive is a very winding road along the Schuylkill River. And, you know, I handled jobs like this, head-on collisions. I knew that would do the trick, you know. And this was like a Wednesday or a Thursday. It was like about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. And that would be important because any other time of the day, I would have probably succeeded in what I set out to do. And, like, the speed limit is 20, and I'm probably doing 50, and I'm cooped, and I'm hungover, and I'm just flying. And as I'm coming down the drive, I remember something happened when I was young on the job. I was, about 22, 23 years old, and it wasn't the worst. It's not even a top 50, but I was always haunted by this, that I was a young guy, and I had to do a notification before, and I knocked on this guy's door, and to me, he was an old guy. He was probably in his late 30s, early 40s, and I had to tell him that his son was killed in an automobile accident. And the only way I can describe it is that I actually saw, like, the life leave this guy. I mean, it's hard to explain, but it was just incredible. I saw him in court a few weeks later, and I didn't even recognize him. I passed him in the hallway. He stopped me. He was an old man. Like, his family was devastated. As whacked as I was that day and wanted to so much pain I needed to in my pain, I knew that I could not inflict that pain on an innocent family. And I now know that was God. It wasn't me, but I didn't know that then. But I still need to end my pain. I couldn't inflict this on another person. So I decided I would wrap myself around a tree, and we got these big old oak trees around the drive, and, you know, I handle jobs like that. Usually get thrown through the windshield or ejected from the vehicle. That does the trick, too. And I just lost it, man. I just started crying. And I'm surprised I didn't get into an accident by accident because I had no control at all. I'm just speeding. I'm cooked. I'm crying. And, again, I now know it's God looking out after me. And I finally pulled over. At the end of the East River Drive is Boathouse Row. And I sat behind the wheel of my car, and I cried like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached into my glove box where I always had a second gun, you know, because they come in handy. And it wasn't there, you know. But my wallet was there. And inside that wallet was that article that I had clipped out of Daily News about 6 weeks before. And it's no longer there, but at the end of the last boathouse was one of those old glass and closed phone booths. And I walked over and I dialed that phone number up on that piece of paper. And the woman who answered that phone, I spoke to this lady like I'd never spoke to anyone in my life before. I told her the truth. I told her everything that was going on in my sad, pathetic, miserable life. And God bless her, she listened patiently, you know. And when I got done, she said, listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital? Somebody be waiting to talk to you. I said, okay. And that was like about a five-minute ride. I drove over to the hospital. They were waiting for me. They admitted me to their 10th floor psychiatric unit. They kept me there for about 3 or 4 days, got me kind of stabilized. From there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville, where I would spend another few weeks in their flight deck before I got put in the alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I didn't think I had a problem with booze. I thought my problem was this short use of other substances. If I left that crap alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I got this mental illness. I inherited this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress stuff they're now talking about. I got this experience on the job. I got this experience in the service. Maybe it's the neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mummer. But it can't be booze because I'm a beer drinker. And the only way you can be an alcoholic, you got to drink hard liquor. You can't be an alcoholic drinking beer. I mean, the only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Patty's Day or New Year's Day or payday. But I was a virgin. I drank beer. Alcoholics were these poor people I was dealing with day in, day out. Not me. I was successful. I mean, I was going places, you know. When I got put in the alcohol ward at the alcohol and drug ward at the VA hospital, by this point I got what? I got about 9 weeks under my belt, so the arrogance creeps back in. So I got to scout the land. You know, you got to check out the layout of the nut ward. And I wander into the day room. I'm in there about 20 minutes. I wander into the day room, and up on the wall I saw the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I zip through them steps. I have about half of them done. I see the amends. So they're screwed. That don't apply to me. Because, you know, you don't say you're sorry. It's like against the rule. You don't do that. But I was just nuts. But what bothered me the most, later that night, two men came up. I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee. Did not know that then. They came up and carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something in his background that I could not identify with, did not relate to, or didn't like, I would immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. Now I'm looking around the group at my peers, and I realized I had made a mistake. I'm not bad as these guys. Most of these guys, you know, that they had marital problems, they had kids who hated them, they weren't nowhere near allowed houses, you know, PFAs, you know, stay away orders. I didn't have that problem. Probably due to the fact that I'd never been married and didn't have any kids. May had something to do with that. A lot of these guys had legal problems. I didn't have any, and not that I was aware of. I mean, probably because I had a gold shield in my back pocket. They had employment problems, not me. Only had one job in my life. I went from high school to the Air Force to the police department. I never had a problem at all, you know. Looking for the differences and not the similarities. But what bothered me the most, without any question, after the meeting, everyone got in a circle and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what your people are about, I don't want nothing to do with you because I hated God. And I know they're strong words, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but you know what? It doesn't even begin to sum up the feelings I had towards God. And believe me, they were all legitimate, you know? And one of the main reasons I hated God was my mom was involved in the church, you know, and she was in the charismatic movement. She thought she could speak in tongues, and there were pictures and candles and all that stuff throughout the house. And I'm 15 years old. I come home from school one day, and I'm in the house about 10 minutes. I come across my mother. She had slit her wrist. And I looked down at her and said, good for you. And I walked out of the house. I got an older guy to go to the state store and get a bottle of wine. I stayed out and drank the wine. And I came home later that night. My father told me what happened. I acted surprised. I said, oh, yeah, how about that? That happened when I was 15. I got sober when I was 27. That's 12 years of hating God. It would be a few more years before I would even address this issue. So I didn't hold hands. I didn't say the prayer. When it came time to get out of the VA hospital, a nurse came up, and I'm about to say this, and please, it's not to get a laugh. She had to be a member of Al-Anon. She was like a beautiful lady. She saw all through my stuff, and that's what it was. It was all like a bravado to keep people at bay, and she saw all right through it. And she said, I need to tell you, the only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you that's the best piece of advice I got. And that's where I would get my recovery. I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get to the VA hospital. The VA hospital does tremendous work. They helped me greatly. They drained the oil, tightened the bolts. I mean, they did some great work. But I would get my recovery in AA, and that's what I did. I go to AA every single day, sometimes two or three times a week. I don't drink coffee. I've never had in my life, so I don't make it. I don't smoke cigarettes. I never have in my life, so I don't have any ashtrays. I walk into a big book meeting or step meeting. Wrong move. I would leave at the break. That's something more important to do. Tradition meetings. Rules. My line of work, we love to enforce them. We don't like to follow them. They're for other people. I was interested in war stories. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't relate, didn't identify with, or just didn't like, I immediately tuned him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. But I made meetings. And that's all I did. And I was crazy as a bedbug. I was sober about 8-9 months, and I'm sitting in this bar because they sold real good roast beef, right? And I'm drinking seltzer in a grog glass, of course, in a, you know. And so I'm drinking this seltzer, and guy from the neighborhood came in, and he, you know, he just started, you know, breaking, you know. He was like, he was giving me a hard way to go. You know, he was like busting my, you know, he was giving me a hard way to go. And I couldn't understand why, because, you know, I was arrogant, you know, and I got a lot of press, and, you know, I thought it was like the best thing since sliced bread. Well, as you can imagine, towards the end of my drinking, there's a lot of negative press associated with my behavior. And that the reason I was in the bar that day wasn't because they had real good roast beef. It was, the truth was, I didn't want anybody, you know, I'm back. Things are cool. I don't know who that guy was. Don't believe that. But here I am. That's why I was there. I was showing off. And unfortunately, he got a little too close to me, and I just had enough, and I stood up, and I punched him right in the face with that rock glass. And I opened him up. He bled like a pig. He dropped to the floor. The uniform guys came in. I knew one of the guys. He just looked at me like I was nuts. He pulled me off the side. I said, "What the hell happened?" And I told him what happened. And I'm telling you, the look of disgust in his eye. But he just shook his head. He said, "Get the hell out of here." And that's where I learned my lessons about people, places, and things. I mean, I could have got it real jammed up there. I mean, that's ag assault. I mean, you know, you get in trouble for that. And so he cut me a break, and I got out of there. And that's where I learned my lessons about people, places, and things. And I have since found a real good place that sells real good roast beef. If you come in the neighborhood, I promise I'm not going to punch anybody with a glass. But that's how nuts I was. I was sober 1 year. My anniversary at my home group at that time, you told your story. When I got done speaking, it was amazing. Thunderous applause, the blind could see, the lame walked. It was really incredible. And people came up and they patted me in the back and said, "Bobby, man, you're doing great." I lied during my entire story. I identified myself as an alcoholic because in my group, that's the only thing you can do. You can't talk about that other stuff. And that's what I thought my problem was. In fact, during my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head, but you guys didn't want to hear that. You want to hear all the quotes, and I'm this pretty sharp guy. I know how to hold on to information, give it back to you, and that's what I did. And they came up and they patted me in the back and said, "Bobby, you're doing so good." And I was dying inside. I felt it yay big. I back off for a moment. My very first outside meeting, I went to this meeting in my neighborhood, and my neighborhood at this time is going through the gentrification process, you know. Them yuppies come in and they ruin everything, you know. They make beautiful loft apartments out of old abandoned warehouses. I mean, how dare they, you know. But it was, AA is just like a microcosm of society. Anything happens out there just happens in here, just a smaller scale. Well, the same thing, the neighborhood changed. And I came into this neighborhood meeting and it wasn't the neighborhood. It was like a lot of people I never knew before, except for one guy. His name was Troubles. And that was a hard-earned nickname. And I saw Troubles. I thought he was dead or in jail, you know. I hadn't seen him in years. And here he was sober almost like 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Damn, he's still sober?" But what was interesting that night, two people, a husband and wife, spoke. They both had 10 years. The wife had one more day than her husband, and she constantly reminded him about throughout her story. And I said, 10 years? I couldn't understand that. Come on. Like, you go over in Jersey and drink and keep your Pennsylvania time? I don't know. I mean, I caught him. It's 10 years. Come on. I mean, they're full of shit. They're full of crap. You know, you can't be doing that. You know? But my guy from the neighborhood, he's sober like 2 years. I said, I was impressed by him. I said, damn. So I would come to meetings. I mean, I was nuts. I was sober 23 months. I beat another man with a baseball bat. Forget what step I was working that day. I swear to God, my early recovery. First of all, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering, why is everybody blowing this guy's anonymity? And I said, he's really tough SOB. I wouldn't tangle with him. When I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid. But here I was, so damn bright, it damn near killed me. You know, I used to go like in my early sobriety, my first couple of years, I used to go to like a lot of gentlemen's clubs, right? And I would get my picture taken, like with the entertainer. And I would come to the meetings and pass the pictures around to the old timers because I figured they would like that. They would look at the picture and they would look at me and they would shake their head and say, please, kid, please keep coming back. And I thought they're being facetious. I said, all right, I'll keep coming back. I was nuts. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had. I didn't carry the message. I carried the disease. I swear to God. I was nuts. I hated everybody. But you know what I hated the most? I hated the people coming behind me. See, we had a cork board. And name, first name, last initial, date of month, how many years you're celebrating. If Joey A. had 3 years and Bobby C. had 2 years and Joey A. went out, I said, good, he's out, I'm in. Everyone's talking about how long you're sober. I thought that's what it was. It was seniority. I didn't care if you went out, good. I wanted you to go out. That's nuts. It was just nuts. I swear, I would go to the men's room or go get something like, you know, go to the men's room or go get something to drink and come back to me. The seat next to me would be empty. They'd be sitting on the other side of the room. The only time I took my hand out to share was to take a shot at somebody. It was just nuts. My second anniversary came, I didn't celebrate it. A month after my second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had before, 25 months before, but 25 months before, I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober, making regular attendance and meetings in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to eat my gun. Safe to assume, my life was unmanageable. I go to a Friday night step meeting. I see this guy, Troubles. I go up to him, I said, Bobby, because he didn't like to be called Troubles because he turned his life around and he's a pretty big dude and you call him whatever you wanted to do. I said, Bobby, I said, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? He looked at me, he said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years and I need to tell you, you're full of shit. That's not the response I'm looking for. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. Hey, you're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment. You're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm saying to myself, who's he talking to? I'm sober 25 months. I'm selling the grapevines. I got it going on. You're nuts. But what I did do, I looked him dead in the eye. I said, okay. And that's wrong, you know. After the meeting, we went back to his house, and this is the night that I took the first 3 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I really knew that. And I wanted to eat my gun. My life was unmanageable. There was no question about that. Statement of acceptance. No need to write on that for 30 days. I was running with it for 25 months. If that's the problem, step two had to be the solution. It had to be a power greater than myself. I now know that I had a misdirected resentment at God and church, but I didn't know that then. And I hated God still. But I knew something was at work, and I'll tell you why. Because at this point, I'm sober 25 months. Okay, you sell, you got 7-8 years. All right, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. You're okay. Unless you're nuts, but all right, you're sober that long. But I saw these people coming in behind me who were just stark, raving lunatics. I saw these guys get better before me. So regardless of my resentment towards God, I knew something was at work because I saw these people. It was the evidence. I saw these people get better before me. And you know what? I hated them the most. Yeah. How dare they get better before me? I'm sober 2 years. You got a year. I know when you came in, you didn't have nothing. And then all of a sudden, you got something. You got your teeth fixed. You're driving. You got a girlfriend. Jesus Christ, no one talks to me. I hated them. I hated them the most. I was nuts. So there had to be a power greater than myself. I knew there was. And the third step, we got on our knees together and we said the third step prayer. And when we got done, he said, Bobby, the way we do a third step, we pick paper and pen up and we do a fourth step. So, whoa, whoa. Easy does it. Let's keep it simple. You know, and I know the slogans, you know, they serve an appropriate. They are. They're appropriate. But you know what? I was twisting them around and using them as an excuse and not to do any work. I didn't want to do one of these. I'm going to meetings. People say, doing my 4 steps, stirring stuff up. I feel like going out. I want to eat my gun. You can't get no further out than that. So I did my inventory. It's not a big deal. It's really not. Everything I wrote down, I did. And next one, that fifth step, that's a big deal. I'm a bright guy. I got this figured out. I called my sponsor up. I said, Bobby, I'm going to go on a retreat this week, and I'm going to do my fifth step with a priest. He said, okay, when you get done, stop by my house so you can do it with me. And you're on the phone. You're on the phone, right? Oh, went out. There it goes. I just had to speak up. I never had a problem getting a drink in a crowded bar. So I don't want to do, you know, so the fifth step, the only reason I want to do it with a priest, it wasn't not to be spiritually enlightened. I got God on the list. I got church on the list. I hate both. They're still there. The hate's still there. The reason I want to do a fifth step with the priest, because of my indoctrination as a kid, I knew whatever I told him be between me, him, and a lamppost. Nobody else would know. The truth was, I didn't want to do my fifth step with my sponsor because there were a lot of things I was embarrassed about. I thought several things would happen. I thought, one, he would pass judgment on me. Secondly, he would ridicule me. Or thirdly, more importantly to me, that he would break the confidence and tell another person what I had told him. Which should tell you that my fearless wasn't quite done, you know. Now, I need to tell you about these retreats. I hate God. You know, this is going on. The worst meeting ever to go to was Sunday night after retreat. I'm at meeting Friday night. I'm saying, where's all the guys at? Like, half the, you know, you got 40 guys in a group, 20 guys at us. Where the hell's everyone at? Saturday night, same thing. Where's everyone at? Sunday night. They was away from retreat the whole weekend. And here they come floating into the meeting. And I never left the meeting, but you know what? Serene people scared the hell out of me, you know? I swear to God, the only time I get my hand up to share, like if it was a calm meeting, because I got uncomfortable. I would get my hand up to start the insanity to watch the show. Now I'm comfortable. I sit back. The meeting's goofy. I'm okay. I'm in my environment. Well, they came up to me one night after a meeting, and they said, Bobby, are you working this weekend? Before I knew it, I said no. And it's too late. I want to pull it back. It was too late. They said, good, we're going to go on a retreat this weekend, and we're going to take you with us. Now, I make fun of these guys, but the truth is they were real good men. They were good men. But I was afraid to tell them about my mom. See, I knew at this point I was in AA long enough to know that you couldn't get kicked out. But unfortunately, my experience was I was in AA long enough to know that not everyone was always greeted as warmly as the next person. For one reason or the other, just my experience. So they put me in the back seat of a car, big guy on each side of me. It's like role reversal because at work I drive, you're in the back seat. Here I am in the back seat with a guy on each side of me. Whoa, there it goes. Thank you. I guess that other stuff wasn't important. This is the important stuff. So I go, I'm in the back seat, and I'm going up to this retreat house. And the closer I get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. Because I know that I got to get honest with these guys. But I'm terrified. I really am. And here it goes, still doing things I'm uncomfortable doing, but they need to be accepted by these guys that outweighed anything else. They were good. They used to come, like after the meeting, I'd be talking to them. They said, Bobby, we're going to the diner afterwards. You want to go with us? I said, no. But I made sure I always got invited. They'd be talking. I'd weasel myself up. Yeah, and they said, we're going to the diner. You want to go? I said, nope. I never went with them. But I got mad if they never invited me. I mean, that's why I'm nuts. I was stupid. So we get to this retreat house. It's Friday afternoon, 4:30, 5 o'clock. We get there. They said, Bobby, we want to introduce you to the retreat master. I said, oh, Christ, okay, come on, let's go. Let's get this over with. They take me to this long, carpeted hallway. I can still picture it. They knock on this door. The guy says, come in. I come in. He's my disciplinarian from high school, this guy. He stands up and gives me a smile, and he comes up and he hugs me. He said, man, it's good to see you. Not only was he my disciplinarian, he's a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He wants to know. I said, how you doing? I said, I'm good, Father. How you doing? And he wants to know the 411, like where you're going to meetings, what the deal is, you know, and I tell him what the deal is. He said, who's your sponsor? I said, I don't have one. See, I'm a pretty bright guy. He knew that. He said, all right. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. So he asked my roommate to be my sponsor that night. God forbid, should I ever be questioned again, who's your sponsor? There he goes, right there. That's my sponsor. The only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. He would wave at me, say, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. You know what I used to do? I used to tell other people, you won't believe this guy. He wants me to do this. He wants me to do that. He didn't do nothing. I made it up. He put the hand of AA out there. Not only did I slap it, then I character assassinate the guy at the boat. I mean, that's how nuts I was. So, I never did that fifth step with that priest. I did it with my sponsor. And they turned out to be unfounded fears because he did not pass judgment on me. He did not ridicule me, and to the best of my knowledge, he never broke the confidence in what I disclosed to him. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his experience with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness in which I thought I was the only guy to do certain things. See, he had also taken someone's life, and he went to prison for it in the 60s, and that's not why he asked him to be my sponsor. He was a man of character. He was a man of dignity and respect, and I loved the way he carried himself. And it was in the neighborhood. It wasn't in the rooms of AA. It was in the neighborhood. He was walking the walk, you know, and he helped me tremendously. I'm about to leave his house. He said, "Yo, where are you going?" So I'm going home. He said, no. He said, "You got to sit quietly for that 1 hour." Now, he lived by himself, and he had a quiet room set up in his house, and he made me sit quietly in that room. Now, at this point, I'm sober 32, 33 months. Please, don't do it as long as I did, but I need to share my experience. 32, 33 months I'm so at this point, and I sit quietly for the hour. I could never sit quietly for 2 minutes. I must have been more than an hour because he knocked on the door. And you know what? I didn't drift off. I just sat there quietly. And the only way I can explain it is that the screaming inside stopped. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but believe me, man, it was a credible relief, you know. And then it was time to do 6 and 7, character defects. I didn't know what these were. I knew when I drank, I was a character. I did my inventory. I found out that I had no character whatsoever. I thought I was the greatest cop in the world, and that wasn't true. I engaged in behaviors and put people at risk, and I compromised the integrity and trust that was entrusted to me. And I thought I was the greatest uncle in the world just because I provided material goods for my nephews and nieces. And it turned out that I wasn't. I wasn't a good uncle. I was a rotten brother and a rotten son. I missed key family engagements, and when I did show up at key family engagements, I usually three sheets to the wind, and I embarrassed them, you know, to the point where I wasn't even invited to family functions anymore, you know. And so as a result of doing my inventory, it was pretty humbling. I had this stuff in front of me, you know. I was a liar, thief, and a cheat. I wasn't dependable. I was a creep. I was a creep with the new women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did everything wrong you could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I didn't do, I didn't pick up a drink. I had no character whatsoever. So the sixth step, I became willing. You know, and the seventh set was a prayer. And my sponsor tells me, "Bobby, you need to put legs in those prayers." I mean, I got a laundry list of character defects. Let's say sometimes I may not be the most patient guy in the world. And I could pray all day long, "God, help me be patient, help me be patient." But during the course of my day, should you cross my path and you try my patience and I lash out in sarcasm, which is nothing but anger, also referred to as language of the Irish, but if I lash out in sarcasm, that prayer for patience goes right out the window. See, God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but this is a program of action. See, I used to be one of them guys, "Oh, I turned it over," you know. That was nonsense. I didn't do nothing. It was just goofy. The eighth step, I made a list. Because I didn't burn my fourth step, when I did my fifth step, half my eighth step was done. And I had to throw more names on that. And I used to be one of these guys going to eighth and ninth step meetings, "Oh, I never harmed anybody but myself." That should have been a tip-off. I never did my inventory because, believe me, after I got done my inventory, everyone I came in contact with, I harmed. And unfortunately, those closest to me the most got harmed the most. The ninth step, direct amends. No phone calls, no letters from me. You know why? Because I didn't beat you with a bat through the mail or over the phone. And I can make up stories, he moves, he's down the shore, or something like that. You know, the truth is, if I want to take those measures, make a phone call, write a letter, if the person's still alive, you know, the truth is I'm probably consumed by fear, you know, if I'm really honest with myself. Direct amends, you know, and I'd like to share two experiences on my ninth step. I'm at a meeting, it's about, I guess, about 15, 16 years ago. Guy walks down the steps. I have not seen this guy since 1977. He is not on my A-step list, not for any fear. I just plain forgot. You know, today more will be revealed. As soon as he came down the steps, I recognized this guy. So he was a big guy. I used to like to fight big guys. I don't know. I wasn't good at it, but I did it. I swear to God, I was in a bar before, and the doorman, because I lived there, so I thought I was obligated to help the doorman. And he was trying to escort this big dude out, and this dude was a monster. And I had a couple sips out of my beer, and I went up with a bottle, and I slapped him on the side of the head. The bottle shattered, and he didn't even flinch. He turned around and said, "Why'd you hit me?" I knew I was in trouble. He took me outside. He's sitting on my chest. I'm lying on the pavement. He's punching me in my face. My head's bouncing off the cement. I look him dead in the eye. I says, "You're in trouble now." Nuts. I think I broke his hand with my nose. I mean, it was just nuts. So this guy was a big dude, and I had words with him one day, and he backed down. So from that point on, whenever I wanted to impress anybody how tough or nuts I was, I would pick on this guy. And I'm, like I said, I'm not a tough guy. I never was. And the verbal taunts, you know, I called them names. One day I slapped him. He didn't do nothing. And then one day I spat upon him. I mean, what worse, the utter degradation of spitting on another human being? It doesn't get any more lower than that. So I recognized him right away, but he didn't recognize me. So I get introduced, and I stand up, I look him dead in the eyes, and my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Now, I need to tell you why I use my full name. I know these traditions are top secret. We won't be getting into them this weekend because you don't have your security clearance, you know, or your decoder ring. God forbid the concepts. But these traditions, they're really misunderstood, and no more so than this 11th tradition. All of a sudden, we get sober. It's like we join the mafia. You know, everyone gets a nickname. There's Bucktooth Mary and Red Sweater Jerry and Pepsi George and Frank the Fox and Jimmy the Coat and John the Brick. I mean, everyone gets a nickname, right? I don't want nobody in my neighborhood to know I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody knows I'm a drunk, though. It was those little telltale signs. They come outside to catch me, I'm urinating on their car. My girlfriend throw her clothes out the window. I'm slumped behind the wheel of the car. Everyone knows I'm a drunk, but God forbid my reputation should be tarnished. The 11th tradition is real clear. At the level of press, personal anonymity, at the level of press, radio, and films. That means you will never see my face clearly identified on television, hear my full name on the radio, Robert Ignatius Benedict Coyle III, followed by the statement, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That would be a violation of the 11th tradition. Dr. Bob and the good old timers said, when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that is a violation of the 11th tradition. He went on to say that anonymity is spiritually inspired and secrecy is spirit inspired. I mean, God forbid, 3 o'clock in the morning, you feel like drinking. Yeah, I'd like to have John the Brick's phone number. Or you want to go visit one of these old-timers, beloved old-timers now. You'll go visit them in the hospital. Yeah, I'm here to see Jimmy the Coat. I mean, if they got a nut word, they're going to admit you. I was very involved in service back home where you use our full name. However, I have no right whatsoever to break your anonymity. If you choose not to use your full name, that's cool. I respect that. But, you know, so off the soapbox, back to the meeting, I looked this guy dead in the eye and said, my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. He nodded. He recognized me. So at the end of the meeting, he comes up and, you know, he hugs me. He forgives me because I made amends to him publicly. And that wasn't a grandstand. See, because I was always told making amends is about righting the wrong. It's not about saying I'm sorry, because for me, that I'm sorry are two words that don't mean squat. You know? And if I owe you money, I go in my pocket and I can pay you back. Or if it's a significant amount, I go on a payment plan with you. But what about the emotional damage or the psychological damage? How do I make amends for that? I was taught that I sit down and have conversations with people. But more importantly, I never exhibit that behavior again. I become a son again. I become a brother. You know, I do these things. But I thought that since I publicly humiliated the guy, the least I could do was make amends to him. It wasn't a grandstand at all. He came up and he hugged me. And so, is that Juanita's phone? So I go up to him. I thought I forgot, huh? So he comes up and he hugs me. And he forgives me. And then we start talking. I said, Bob, how you doing? He said, I'm doing good. How you doing? I said, all right. I said, how long are you sober? He said, I'm sober 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now the arrogance creeps back in, right? Because I'll tell you why. Because I live in South Philadelphia. Bob lives up in Roxborough, which is considered like Northwest Philadelphia. And this meeting is in North Philadelphia. And I figured this is a meeting that he and I normally would not attend. But the fact that he's sober 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sober 5 or so, that he would know me, because everyone in AA knows me in Philadelphia. I'm not saying they like me. I say they know me. You know, they know me. So I said, Bob, what made you come here tonight? He said, Bobby, I was flipping through the meeting directory tonight, and I was just looking for a different meeting to attend. I said, okay. Our meeting directory is 90 pages thick. We have 1,600 meetings a week. I am a firm believer that my God put that guy in my path that night, and I had two options. I could do what I did, or I could do what I always did, which was, when you have 8 siblings in a 10-year span, there is very close resemblance. And people would come up to me and say, hey, you SOB, I remember you. I said, oh, no, you got me confused. You're talking about my brother Brian, my brother Sean, not me. And I had to make amends with my brothers. Yeah, I know you're a Coyle. I don't know which one you are. So, nice step. You know, I made the amends. He forgave me. Incredible experience. Now, flip back to my home group at the time was the Stepping Stones group of Philadelphia. And I'm in the meeting one time. It was a Sunday morning business meeting. I make a motion for it. It definitely had to be a betterment of AA. It had to be since I made it. It had to be. An incredible thing happened. My motion doesn't get seconded, which is unbelievable. I see every motion get seconded for no other reason. You feel bad for the poor guy who made it. I mean, I can see if it was a crazy motion, like, okay, the last Friday of the month, I think we ought to have a keg of beer. I can see that not getting accepted. But anything else gets, come on, fair game, all right, you know. So, but made matters worse, my boy Freddie's in the room, and he and I, we're making eye contact. I'm looking at Freddie. He doesn't get the hand up. I can't believe it. See, I grew up in a neighborhood. I mean, we had certain rules. Everyone knew it. Like, you always backed your boy. It didn't matter whether it got you beat up. You could always discuss that later with them. But you always had your boy's back. Secondly, like, if I liked you and I thought you were cute, I said, you know, I think you're nice. But, you know, you dated Salvi like 8 years ago. I can't talk to you. It's a neighborhood rule. Everyone knows it, you know, and you just don't do certain things. So I'm looking at this guy. My motion goes down in flames. It doesn't get seconded. I'd never talk to him again. I didn't care. I come to the room, there'd be 10 people there. I'd say hi to all of them except Freddie. So the hell with him. I'm at work one day. My coworker came up to me. He was in the program. He came up to me. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels is outside. Want to take care of some sort of business? I peeked out my window. I saw him. I said, you know what? Tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall. He can't do that here. A couple weeks later, that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels died last night. He said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. As God is my judge, I cannot tell you what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. And once I would get off my spiritual high horse, when I felt it was time, I would make amends to him. He has put my path many, many times, and I chose not to make amends to him. And the moment that my coworker said, Bobby, because he always spoke so highly of you, I felt about yay big. You know? See, that key word in the 9-step is wherever possible. I used to thought to say whenever possible. Whenever's time, wherever's place. And for me, it's never the right time because I'm too busy easy, doesn't it? You know? The 10-step is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I'm standing up here and tell you I do a 10-step every day, that's not true. I'm pretty good with it, though. 4, 5, 6, 7 times a week sometimes. It all depends. Depends what type of mood I'm in. And I always said if I'm not practicing these principles, if I don't do a 10-step every day, no one knows but me. See, that's not true either. See, because when I'm not practicing these principles on a regular basis, I operate in nitwit mode. When I operate in nitwit mode, should you cross my path, you too are affected. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing how contagious that can be. The funny thing, now I can now laugh at myself. I can never laugh before. And to be honest, I think it's the greatest sound in an AA meeting is laughter, you know. And if you're new, please, man, laugh. It's, you know, my Cliff talks about it, you know, once you giggle, like, we got you. It's an incredible sound, you know. But it's just amazing, you know. And but I can laugh at myself because once I mess up, I said, like, yourself, when you go for the SOB, like, when you want to get this thing, you know? I can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety, just like I couldn't stay drunk on yesterday's load. And I've been on some good loads, 2 or 3 days, you know, sometimes with some certain enhancements, you could stay a little bit longer. But sooner or later, you come to, and the only way to maintain that load, you need to do some more. It's the same thing about recovery. I can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety. The 11th step to me is nothing, you know, it's kind of personal, and I don't want to tell you how I pray and meditate for just one reason. I don't want to offend anybody here, because when I got sober, first of all, my motive wasn't good, and thank God we don't judge us on our intentions, but I had a resentment towards God and church that was blocking me off, you know, from the sunlight of the Spirit, and I was unwilling, refused to listen to anything. There may be someone of you like that, so I don't want to offend you the way I pray and meditate, but I can tell you this. There are thousands of books on both those subjects, and I'm about to give you my opinion. I hardly ever do this from the podium, but when I do, I always qualify it. I think that's what the hospitality room is for, you know, but here it is, my opinion. This is why I think Alcoholics Anonymous is so successful, because you guys have given me the freedom to pray and meditate in a way in which I feel comfortable. Because if there were only one way to pray and meditate, I guarantee you would have a different speaker this evening. You guys have given me the freedom to do things over the last 19 years, and I now pray and meditate. The way I do it now, I've been doing like the last 7 years, and I'm pretty good with it. I kind of like it. It works for me. That's the 11th. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I did the steps. I had the awakening. No burning bushes, no lightning bolts, no voices from above. In fact, it's been a number of years since I heard any voices at all, and I'm truly grateful for that. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to thousands of meetings since I've been sober. I hear some crazy things, and that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, having had a spiritual awakening. If I 12-step somebody and don't mention God or the spiritual part, and it's not even the spiritual part because the whole program is spiritual, if I can't mention God, then I'm lying. Because left to my own devices, I'm a liar, thief, and a cheat. You know. But the most important part of this 12th step is to practice these principles in all my affairs. I'm only in AA an hour and a half a day. What about the other 22 and a half hours? What about the time at work or the time in my neighborhood where it's tough to do the right thing all the time? You know, I never had the courage to do the right thing. I hid behind a badge. I hid behind a bottle. I learned how to do the right thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I make mistakes. Man, I make mistakes. You know, making mistakes is not going to get me drunk. It's the arrogance of not learning from those mistakes or defending those mistakes. That's what will happen. That's what will lead to a drink for me. You know, I'm not the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I invite you, come live with me for a week. I've done it a couple times, and they kind of regretted that. But come live with me for a week. See what type of guy that I am. But I know this. I know I'm not whacking guys with bats today. I'm not using other people's credit cards. I'm not making passes at other guys, you know, significant others. I'm not doing all of that creepy stuff that I did sober. You know? But I just try to do the right thing. The 12th step is incredible. That's what we're supposed to do. And the 12th step comes in many forms and fashions, you know. There's a lot of different, and when you get involved in 12th step work, you learn about the traditions. And I love the traditions. The traditions are to the group what the steps are to the individual. You hear the steps are how it works, or the traditions are why it works. And the whole history of the traditions. And the traditions allow us to be wrong. But if we're wrong just for the sake of being wrong, it says in the first tradition, the penalty assurance, it says these are a group of spiritual principles that we must adhere to, or the penalty is sure and swift. We sicken and die. I don't know about you, but that tells me something serious is going to happen. You know. But I love 12-step work because that's what we're supposed to do. I give you, a number of years ago, and my friend Wallace is going to talk about this Sunday. This is probably about 15 years ago. And my sponsor calls me up. He said, Bobby, we're going to go to a prison commitment on Monday night, Holmesburg Prison. It's since been closed, prison in Philadelphia. I said, we're not going. He said, we are. I said, I'm not going. He said, we are. See, I didn't think I had anything to offer to these guys. What I did professionally, I thought I would have to use profanity. I thought I would need to embellish my story to be accepted by these guys. He said, Bobby, they don't care what you do. You could be a pizza delivery guy. They don't need to know that. You got a message of hope. That's what you carry to this guy. I said, oh, all right. So he asked me like a week before. The commitment's Monday night. So he asked me like the previous Monday. I guess when he left, that's when he called me up. Well, Friday, I realized I definitely can't go now. Because the Eagles are playing the Cowboys Monday Night Football. You definitely can't go now. So I call him up. I said, Bobby, I can't go. You know, he said, Bobby, you gave me your word. It's a commitment. And then he went on to say, he said, besides, if you pick up a drink, I don't think Randall Cunningham's going to come over and 12-step your ass. And he hung up on me. So we went up to the prison. And it's a, you know, you got to, there's some rules you have to adhere to because we are their guest, and, you know, you get buzzed and, you know, certain things, you got to leave everything in the car, certain things you can and cannot bring in. So we go through the whole process and we show up at the meeting. No one shows up. They're all on the block watching the game. Now I really got a resentment. As I leave, I make some sort of flippant remark to the CEO on the gate. I guess you transferred all your alcoholics to Greaterford, huh? He didn't know what the hell I was talking about. I'm driving down 95. I got the game on the radio. He wants to talk. Oh, please, shut the hell up. Trying to listen to the game, catch a score. He knows. He picks up on that I'm ticked off right away. He said, you don't get it, you selfish SOB. He said, we were here just in case they showed up. We are responsible for the effort, not the outcome, you know. And, you know, I did it for a while, but then, you know, it just for me, it just wasn't the deal. And prisons aren't for everyone. And there's a lot of 12, it's great work. It's important work. And if you got the time and you got the clearance, go ahead and do it. but there's a lot of 12 different 12-step work opportunities. There's PI, there's public information, you know, there's treatment facility committee, you know, there's CPC. That's not PCP. CPC, Cooperation with Professional Community, where you take a professional student to an open AA meeting, so for one day when they're practicing their profession, whether they're doctors or nurses or ministers, they'll know how to send a patient or a parishioner to Alcoholics Anonymous. Some great work. I am a firm believer that every person in this room has a gift. It may be different than the person sitting next to you, but it's your gift. You need to find out what it is. The committee that put this work on is 12-step work. Now, they may be sniping at each other, and I don't know a committee that doesn't yell at each other. In fact, if you're not yelling at each other, you guys did something wrong. But, you know, this is 12-step work, you know? We have a statement of responsibility. I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. For that, I'm responsible. I can't worry what other people are doing. But I got into the service. I loved it, and it was a great experience. And I know I've been speaking for a while, but let me finish this up. I was in Mexico a number of years ago. I thought I could speak Spanish. For all them years I worked in the barrio, my Spanish consisted of, like, dame pistola, which means give me your gun. So I'm the only English-speaking person in the room. I'm telling my staff, I'm introduced myself, and, you know, and these people are looking at me and say, what the hell is he saying? So I switched back to English because I didn't want to offend anybody or insult anybody. And you know what? They still didn't understand. But at the end of the meeting, they came up and they hugged me. They understood. Language of the heart. And I could look at the old-timer was by the surrender in their face, and I could tell who the new guy was by their pain in their face. They may not have understood, but you know what? They understood. It's a wonderful way of life. You know, I finished up like this. You know, I was going places in AA. You know, I remember a guy came up to me. He said, Bobby, I'm going to say, you're really going to go far in AA. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, because you've got such a long way to go. Yeah. But, you know, I got involved in service, and I wound up getting sick in 1993. Got diagnosed with lung cancer. I mean, I never smoked in my life. I'm a little reefer, but that don't count. So I went to go get a second opinion, and it got confirmed. And, you know, I had a tough time with this. I don't want to think I handled it well, because I didn't. I actually, to be honest, when I got the word, I actually got sick. And I got sick. I went to a treatment. I bounced back. I was pretty good. And then I really got sick, like really sick. Chemo and, you know, radiation, surgery, you know. They actually removed the lower left lobe of my lung. And I was actually training to do the Boston Marathon. And Boston, you qualify. I mean, there's a couple lottery spots, but you actually qualify. So I was actually training to do the Marine Corps Marathon to qualify for Boston. And that's why I went to get checked up, because just things weren't happening. And when I got diagnosed, I thought maybe, you know what, I had an excuse to go out and get loaded. But the real deal is, you know, even though I may have an excuse, I didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. Because I made thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw some men and women go through some terrible things through no fault of their own, and they got through it one day at a time. You know, that's what we promise you. We promise you another day, or we promise you the strength to handle anything without picking up a drink, you know. So I bounce back, then I really get sick, and then I get laid up, after surgery. I'm in the hospital, and I come home, and I couldn't make meetings. And I'm a meeting maker, you know. 1,600 meetings a week, there's no reason not to make a meeting. And I love midnight meetings, man. Midnight meetings are, man, they're just wonderful. They are, you got guys with capes and ray guns, and guys who work in seconds. They are people, they are people going any length to get sober. Someone working second shift coming to a meeting, or just the people who just are cooped. And, you know, they're just great. So I make meetings, but I couldn't make meetings. I'm laid up in my house. Well, people who I knew from the assembly or from service, they start coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just not talking friends of mine. I'm talking about somebody I met once or twice, or someone I never met before, you know, coming along with somebody else to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're looking at a liar, thief, and cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people came to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and my doctors did a pretty good job, but I think it was the prayers in AA that helped tremendously. And I've been back and forth. It's been a while since any treatment, and I know I put a couple pounds on. I'm glow in the dark and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm all right today, you know. I got a pretty good life today. What's going on today? You know, I have 20 years of service with the city on May 10th. I am actually no longer a police officer. Wind up doing something else with the city, and but that's okay. You can still come up and talk to me. If I know guys don't like to talk to cops. Listen, if you got any warrants, you got to turn yourself in, fellas. We got computers, you know. That stuff's not going on. And seriously, when you turn yourself in, and I've helped a lot of people turn themselves in over the number of years, when you do it on your own, you got some credibility. Like if we pull you over for a traffic stop and then we find out you're wanted, you no longer have credibility. But I've been with the city for a while, and that's incredible. What happened to that little kid on that bike? You know that old saying, God takes care of drunks, fools, and kids? Well, I hit the trifecta that day because the kid wasn't hurt seriously at all. And to make a really strange, I once heard coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. Even though I did not know the kid, his family was friends of my family. and the kid wasn't hurt seriously at all. And thank God, because if he were, that could have changed the dynamics of everything else, and I probably wouldn't be here today, you know. And it's just a wonderful way of life, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, I wish you well. I don't wish you luck, because luck has nothing to do with it. I encourage you to get a home group. I encourage you to get a sponsor. If your sponsor has not done the steps, he has no business sponsoring you. Get a sponsor who has done the steps. How do you find out? I'll tell you. You go up and you ask them. You're going to hear two things, yes or no. The guy says yes, that's your person, you know. I used to have, I dated a girl for a while. We lived together, and her name was Ruby. And Ruby was 19 when she got sober, and she was a Pakistani Muslim. And she always said if she waited for another 19-year-old Pakistani Muslim to come along, that she probably wouldn't be sober today. She got sober in a neighborhood with a bunch of Irish Catholic roofers. Guys, both her parents were physicians, and she got sober in a neighborhood that was very, very rough. And they took her under their wings, and they kept her from the predators long enough to turn over to the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. So you never know whose hand's going to be extended, you know. You know, we are people who normally would not mix, you know. So from Yale to jail, huh? Well, in my case, from Yale, from Penn to jail. So this is what sponsorship is. It's like I grew up in a neighborhood where everyone's sign of success was to get a union card. You want to get, you know, and we had special, we had different levels, you know. Obviously, if you were an iron worker, you were doing a little bit better than an electrician who was a little bit better than a carpenter. So like we all had different, you know, but the sign of success was to get a union card, to try to have some like a middle class life, or you became a cop or a fireman, or, you know, you joined the post office, but some sort of civil service like that. But if you joined the building trades, let's say electrician, you were an apprentice. You work on the job 4 days a week, 1 day a week you go to school. At the end of your 4 years, you become a journeyman. Well, that's what sponsorship is. You're new in AA, you're the apprentice. You hook yourself up with a journeyman who's been through the journey. He takes you through the steps. Then you become a journeyman, and you take an apprentice under your wing. It's a wonderful way of life. I wish you well. I don't wish you luck because I've been lucky and got nothing to do with it. I spoke long enough, and I thank you very much for the privilege, and it is a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I got. Thanks.